I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. With plenty to digest on the national and international scenes, from the government's overnight shutdown to the stock market's meltdown, to yet more staff changes in the upper levels of the Trump administration and the upper echelons of athletes gathering in Pyeongchang for the Olympics, our focus on today's news wrap is local. Jane Miller from WBAL Television joins me with thoughts on the corruption trial of two Baltimore police officers as a jury deliberates their fate. And the General Assembly is 1 month into its 2018 session. WYPR's Annapolis correspondent Rachel Bay has a status report from the State House. Plus, the acclaimed essayist Tim Kreider introduces his new collection, I Wrote This Because I Love You. That's all coming up on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, on this Friday edition of Midday. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. For nearly 3 weeks, in the trial of two Baltimore police officers indicted on corruption charges, a steady stream of witnesses, including other members of the elite gun trace task force who have pleaded guilty to similar charges, have detailed longstanding practices by many officers that involved robbery, drug dealing, and lying about overtime. It is one of the largest cases of police corruption in the history of the city and one of the most pernicious examples of police misconduct in the country. A jury of 9 women and 3 men heard testimony from more than 32 witnesses, some of whom had been alleged victims of Officer Daniel Herschel and Officer Marcus Taylor. The testimony unfurled a dark canvas of banditry and abuse that has further solidified suspicion and mistrust in the police long held by many people of color throughout the city. Jurors in the Gun Trace Task Force corruption trial have been dismissed for the weekend. They will reconvene their deliberations on Monday. Award-winning investigative reporter Jane Miller of WBAL Television joins me on the phone. She's been covering this story since it began almost a year ago. Hey, Jane, how you doing?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Doing fine. Thanks. So for listeners who haven't been paying close attention to this trial for the last 3 weeks, give us a thumbnail sketch of what the officers are charged with and what's happened during the course of this trial.
Well, there were originally 7 members of the Gun Trace Task Force indicted back in March of 2017. Then there was an 8th, a sergeant, who was added to that. The 2 that are on trial are Daniel Herschel and Marcus Taylor. There are 6 others who have already pleaded guilty. Key in this case are the 4 officers who pleaded guilty who have testified, and they have testified to a litany of crimes committed as police officers under the shield of their badge and the power to get search warrants, subpoenas, etc. So the basic MO of the conspiracy, as alleged, is that they would target people that they knew had a lot of cash. So those were mostly drug dealers, high-end drug dealers. They would then enter the property of these dealers and, in some cases, take them into custody, arrest them. And in the course of the seizure of whatever they could find inside the property, they would submit some and take the rest. So there's a wide range of allegations of taking $200,000 in one case, splitting it up among themselves, just a couple of $100 in other cases. The people targeted that have testified are both very high-end. One dealer, for example, that testified and clearly didn't want to be there, but testified that he had, at the time he was arrested and taken into custody by members of the task force, he had in his house 10 kilograms of drugs and $300,000 cash. What got submitted was $100,000 in cash and 8.5 kilos of drugs. So that leaves in the lurch 1.5 kilos of drugs and $200,000 cash, and that is the allegation that members of the task force that were involved in that particular case took it for themselves. That it kind of probably sums up the case as succinctly as we can. As for the overtime abuse, those allegations center on the practices, the illegal practice, both illegal and unauthorized practices. The illegal practice is submitting falsified overtime slips to claim pay and overtime when you weren't working at all. And secondly, what really came to light in this case was the unauthorized practice of the department using overtime essentially as a bonus system, not just to compensate for work actually done, but to bonus, as a bonus for getting a gun off the street, for making a particular arrest, oh, go take the day off. That's the so-called slash day. Those practices certainly were front and center in this case, even though they're not the illegal practices. But they did come to light. Those were among the newer revelations that came out of this case.
Do you have any insight as to why these two officers, Herschel and Taylor, chose to go to trial when six of the total of eight, decided to plead guilty? There was actually a ninth officer, an officer who's working in Philadelphia.
Eric Snell. He's pending trial.
He was indicted in November. And as you say, the original indictments came back in March of 2017. So we're almost a year into this odyssey. But why did these two decide to go to trial? I mean, other than their obvious response would be, that they are pleading not guilty to the charges. But, obviously their defense attorneys had access to the evidence that the state or that the federal government had against them. They knew what they were up against. Do you have any insight as to why they decided to do this when the others didn't?
Well, I can tell you that based on the testimony in court and hearing the opening and closing statements and arguments in this case, that I can give you my best observation. And I got to take them separately. In Daniel Herschel's case, what he's trying to do is convince the jury. He's trying to get away from the count that's called the Hobbs Act robbery, which is it has the highest penalty. So what he's telling jurors is, look, I didn't go into these houses with the intent to rob anybody. Yes. Once the robbery took place, I shared in some of the proceeds. So he's really arguing that he is guilty of theft by conversion or receiving stolen property, but not the more serious case of robbery. What he's up against is testimony from several people who were arrested by him, directly arrested by him, that claim that he took money from them in the course of the arrest. And what he submitted was not the amount they had on their person, and those folks testified. In the case of Marcus Taylor, he is the defendant in the case that probably has the least amount of allegations against him. He was really portrayed throughout the case as a follower, not a leader. And so what he's hoping for is, I actually thought the defense lawyers in this case, in their cross-examination, in their closing arguments, did a great job of trying to pick apart the credibility of the witnesses. All of the witnesses in the case, the key witnesses that were testifying under immunity for the most part. And also to raise those questions about, where's the corroboration of this statement, et cetera. What Taylor is trying to do is exactly that. He's trying to raise such serious credibility issues of the witnesses and the lack of corroboration. And I'll give you an example of what she did yesterday in court. This is Taylor's defense lawyer. There's a very key allegation in the case against Taylor that after the a particular robbery, a very large robbery, in fact, it was the case example I used of this guy who had all this cash in the house, that he and three other officers that were involved went to Taylor's house to split up the money. Why'd they go there? Because Taylor didn't have any. This was all according to Maurice Ward, one of the convicted officers who testified. They went there because Taylor doesn't have anybody at home. There's no one else in the house. The defense lawyer in her closing argument yesterday said, you should ask yourselves this question, jurors. You should ask, why doesn't the government have cell phone records that would put those four officers on that date at that location by using cell phone data, tower data, et cetera, et cetera? There is no, that would be a powerful piece of corroboration, wouldn't it? And yet it wasn't done. Well, there are a million reasons why they might not have that data, but it was never discussed in court. She just brought this up at a closing argument as a means to try to raise reasonable doubt. It was effective. It got to be thinking, gee, I wonder why they don't have that data.
But if you think about it hard enough, there are plenty of reasons.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. Right. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to raise a question in a juror's head.
And as you mentioned, problem. William Purpura, the defense attorney for Daniel Herschel, said, he did some bad things. He just didn't do things that are quite as bad as the federal government alleges.
Correct.
He's really trying to get.
So the defense lawyer spent a lot of time in this case really going after these guys who are current or were at one time drug dealers. In fact, that was kind of one of the highlights of the case, was when one of those guys who said he's no longer dealing drugs, did before went off in the courtroom. I mean, exploded in the courtroom because he got really frustrated by being repeatedly asked, how can you afford that house if you're not, essentially, how can you afford that house if you're not dealing drugs? And so the defense...
Yeah, this is a big house in really Carroll County and all that.
Right? Correct. $500,000 house. You're only reporting $136,000 in income from selling cars and a couple of other things. You know, what? Any rate, the unwritten argument there is that to try to convince a couple of those jurors is, look, this money's dirty to begin with. This is drug money that's getting stolen. So what? I mean, that's, I hate to say it that kind of bluntly, but that's clearly what the theory, you know, that you're trying to operate with is to try to portray these crimes, to try to mitigate the crimes by the persons that are targeted. I got to tell you, Tom, one of the most remarkable things about this case is to watch U.S. federal prosecutors prop up the credibility of drug dealers to justify against cops.
Really, I mean, something. Yeah, it's something. This whole thing
is total reverse.
Yeah, this is through the looking glass stuff from day one.
That's exactly right.
And you know, Jane, regardless of the verdict in this case, and the jury is not deliberating today. There was evidently a juror who requested, who said there was a particular hardship for her or him to be involved today. So they've moved it to Monday. They're going to start at 9 o'clock. They usually start at 10 o'clock. So we won't know anything about a verdict until you know sometime next week. But the ramifications for the Baltimore Police Department are huge. I mean, there are 12 other officers who've been accused of wrongdoing in the course of the details that have emerged through the testimony in this trial. So, and these are not people who've been indicted. But do you guess? I mean, as a person who's covered trials like this for decades now, I mean, would you care to speculate that there may be some more indictments coming down related to this kind of activity by the police?
There are two things I don't predict. I don't predict indictments, and I don't predict juries. I can tell you what we heard, and that is that the FBI agent, the lead agent in the case, was very clear that this is an ongoing investigation. So, yeah, stay tuned. I just came from a news conference with Daryl D'Souza, the new designee for police commissioner, and he outlined in the course of that news conference, without prompting, I might add, some of the things that he's already implementing. They include an overtime abuse unit that he says will have a fiscal agent. This is long overdue in this police department. This police department gets a blank check written every year. This year they're on pace for $50 million in overtime. That's a lot of money that could be used in a lot of different ways. He's going to do random polygraphs of officers that are assigned to these specialized units, which is, of course, where all the trouble is in this case. And he's also going to do... random integrity tests. That's something that has been tried before in the case, but or in over the years without a whole lot of success. So we'll see if it gets done any differently. He's starting a corruption unit to look at specifically the allegations that came out of this case. I think most importantly, I ask him this question because some have suggested this, that maybe what's really needed is for there to be an outside commission appointed to really come in and investigate to the core the practices and the acts in the police department, you know, kind of using the GTTF case as a basis for that. And he said, quote, I actually love that idea. It's something that we are actively discussing on my team. So stay tuned on that, too. I think the biggest crime, so to speak, would be for this case to come to a conclusion, whatever happens to these particular folks on trial and these specific allegations, the biggest crime would be that everybody walks away and nothing happens. These allegations, Tom, to many people, they're shocking. To the people in communities in Baltimore City, these are not shocking allegations.
Right, just like the Department of Justice report in 2015 wasn't shocking. Yeah, exactly.
No, that's exactly right. It's the I told you so. I mean, I've learned this over the years that in some quarters in the city, there is real fear of being robbed by the police, of being unfairly targeted and robbed. And all of that.
And instances of planting evidence and all of that kind of stuff.
Correct. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so one of the details that emerged was this, you know, bag full of pharmaceuticals that were.
That was probably a shocking revelation. Okay. That was like, are you kidding me? So on April 27th, 2015, this is according to the bail bondsman, who was the drug seller for Wayne Jenkins. His allegation is that on April 27, 2015, late at night, Wayne Jenkins shows up at his house over in Bully's Quarters with two trash bags full of pharmaceuticals.
And Wayne Jenkins is a police officer, we should remind people. And this is the day of the uprising and riot.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's right. So he is essentially looting the looters.
Yeah.
Now, I got to tell you, think about that. Just think about that. First of all, that was an all-hands-on-deck night for the Baltimore Police Department, right?
Sure.
And there was a lot of controversy later about what they did or didn't do or stood down, whatever. But here you've got a supervisor in an elite gun trace task force that operates kind of citywide. And what's he doing?
Stealing drugs.
And
Commissioner Batts at the time said, you know, the uptick in violence was due in part to territorial battles between gangs about all these drugs that had just been stolen from the CVS and all the other drugstores at the time. Yeah, it's just
this case has really dinged a lot of those myths,
yeah,
a lot of those theories because of the revelations from the people who were involved in these crimes. And the other thing that I think is very important, while the wiretap allegations, and that's what makes this case so strong, covered 2015 and 2016, the testimony of the officers involved goes back 10 years.
Yeah, way back.
And that should not be lost on anyone as the new commissioner does consider going back to plainclothes policing. Because it's that plainclothes, those plainclothes units, they were called special enforcement units. They weren't called GTTF at the time, but they were very prolific in the years of 2008, 2009, 2010. And everybody should take a lot of caution out of the testimony that came from
right.
the four officers who talked about taking money from people as far back as 10 years ago.
And Jane, I know we got to let you go, but just in our last 30 seconds, one of the things that also came out in this trial is it raised some doubts about the integrity of Detective Sean Suter, of course, who died for reasons that have yet to be fully understood a few months ago. That's going to change the tenor of that whole investigation, too, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I must say that those allegations came from Mamadou Gando, and I believe that's who was testifying at the time. And I was aware at the time of Suter's death, shortly, and I was aware pretty quickly that he may have been, you know, involved in grand jury testimony. When that was confirmed, I was hearing a lot of very kind of quiet rumbling that he was showing some concern about testifying in the case because he was afraid he was going to be outed, that he was going to be exposed. Which, you know, the suicide theory in that case, which has been present from the beginning of the investigation, that kind of feeds into that, too.
And so, the theory is that he committed suicide, but he tried to make it look like a murder so that his family would be able to get life insurance.
I'm not sure we're ever going to know, Tom. Not sure we're ever going to know specifically what happened. I do know that the Commissioner D'Souza has spoken about looking at that case carefully and I think trying to make an honest assessment of it about what to do with it. It was, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on around that case, both kind of publicly and politically, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the FBI was asked to come in. They didn't want to take it. And the fact that these allegations were spoken in court,
it raises it to a different level. I think the fact that it's now on the record in the court. Yeah.
I was aware that this was part of that whole story.
All right. Well, Jane Miller, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend, and we will stay in touch with you because you are certainly very much on top of this story as you have been for the past year. Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, Tom. Thank you.
Jane Miller heads the I-team of investigative reporters at WBAL Television here in Baltimore. Next up, we're going to shift our attention to Annapolis. We'll get an update on the General Assembly as they pass the one-month mark in this year's session. Rachel Bay joins me after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, three perspectives on immigration. Journalist Jennifer Mendelson describes her Twitter project, hashtag resistance genealogy. University of Maryland professor Perla Guerrero talks about immigrant communities and their impact on how people experience the notion of place. And Maria Elena Hincapié will join us. She's the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center. We'll talk to her about what's next for DACA. That's all coming up Monday here on Midday. If you've just joined us, it's the Midday News Wrap today. We're concentrating on local and state stories. So now we turn our attention to the State House in Annapolis, where we are just about 1 month into the 2018 legislative session, which began January 10th. WYPR's Rachel Bay joins me here in Studio A. How you doing, Rachel?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing fine, thanks. So let's talk about a couple of things that have been cooking in this first month of the session. The sick leave bill was passed last year by the legislature, vetoed by the governor, unvetoed by the legislature this time, but then there was some talk about delaying its implementation. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, the Senate this week passed a bill that would delay the implementation of paid sick leave till July 1. The idea is to give businesses and the government enforcers of the law more time to adjust to the changes. But it was introduced in the House today, but it doesn't look like it's going to advance in the House. It would need to move very quickly to beat the deadline, which is Sunday, because Sunday is when the sick leave law takes effect.
All right. So if you're running a business and you are now required to offer paid sick leave, you've got to have the software that you might need to run with your payroll or whatever. You got to be ready by Sunday.
Yes, and employees will also be able to accrue if businesses that have at least 15 employees will be required to offer this to employees, and so employees will be able to begin accruing sick leave starting Sunday.
So I know Richard Montalano, Delegate Mono in the House, were very angry about the notion of delaying the implementation of this law. They said, look, this was passed last year. They've had plenty of time to businesses and everybody, the state has had plenty of time to get their act together. There was really just no sentiment towards delaying this in the House, was there, even though the Senate was able to come to a decision to do that very same thing?
Well, so actually, Madalino and Mano are in the Senate, and even in the Senate, the Democrats, a lot of them, it was a fairly close vote. I mean, it wasn't immediately close, but it was there was a lot of Democratic opposition to the idea of delaying this, even in the Senate, and it did pass. But in the House, it doesn't sound like there's any appetite for this whatsoever. This is a bill that originated in the House, and the Democrats in the House and the chair of the committee that would need to have the hearing on the bill in an expedited fashion, they have no appetite for it.
Yeah, so the governor was not a big fan of this bill. Obviously, he vetoed it. He proposed his own version of it. That never got anywhere. So now the businesses need to get hustling. Of course, the argument is that, well, they've had all this time since last April, and they should have been on the stick now.
That's exactly right. A lot of the Democrats say, they kind of blame the governor for this. They say that the governor's been pushing this idea that his bill might advance instead of the paid sick leave law that they passed last year, or that it would actually get delayed. In the State of the State, he even called for a delay or fixes to the paid sick leave law that is supposed to take effect this Sunday. But it's, you know, the Democrats who are saying this are basically saying, well, the businesses should have known better. They should have been prepared. This is something we passed last spring. It's something that's been in the works for many years now. And the businesses that employ these, it's an estimated 700,000 workers who will get sick leave as a result of this new law. And those businesses, the Democrats are arguing, should have known what was coming, and they should have been prepared, and they procrastinated. So that's on them.
There has been a lawsuit filed by HBCUs, the Historically Black Colleges and Universities. It's been going on for years. There was a decision by a district court, or I forget which court, I think it was the district court in November, having to do with duplication of programs at places like, you know, Morgan State or University of Maryland Eastern Shore, whether or not they are duplicated and given short shrift versus places like Towson University, the University of Maryland College Park. The governor has offered $100 million to settle the suit. Where's that idea going?
So this There's a long history here. The $100 million settlement offer came after a $50 million settlement offer from the state in the past. And the state Senate kind of took a moment to discuss the possibility of this $100 million settlement on the floor yesterday. And it was not well received by particularly the a lot of the Black senators who and those who represent parts of Baltimore, Senator Joan Carter Conway, Senator McFadden. They said, you know, this $100 million, it's a nice starting point. We're glad to see the governor and his administration are offering something, but we don't expect it to end here.
There are some bills floating around, so, I mean, that's also going to complicate this as well. It's not just settlements of the suit, but also some actual legislation. So we'll keep an eye on that. There was a bill that was finally passed this year after, I think, 10 years or so, and this has to do with parental rights for men who have become fathers in the course of a rape. What's going on with that?
Yes. So this is a bill that, as you said, Kathleen Dumais, a delegate in the House from Montgomery County, she has introduced some version of this as far back as 2007. And it finally passed. It got unanimous votes in both the House and the Senate. And the governor has said he's going to sign it. What it does is it creates a court process for women who have been raped and gotten pregnant as a result of that rape to go before a judge and say, I would like to remove parental rights from the man who attacked me. And the judge is able to then take parental rights away from one parent, as opposed to in the past, both parents would lose their parental rights when a judge takes them away.
So it's a legal remedy that was not available to women heretofore.
It was not available. And it's something that a lot of other states have already done. And Maryland was heavily criticized for not doing this. It's something that even it passed actually unanimously last year in the House as well, but it ended up dying on sine die because the House and Senate passed different versions and couldn't come to agreement. So this is something that was considered to be long overdue, and the Senate passed the House version yesterday, so it finally is able to go to the governor's desk, and as I said, Governor Hogan has said he will sign it.
Yeah, right, so there's no disagreement there, no veto possibility in this situation. Taxes. It's been on everybody's mind since late November, early December. The U.S. Congress and Senate passed a historic tax bill, but that's going to have all sorts of ramifications for people who live in Maryland, and the governor and the legislature have vowed to tweak the Maryland tax code to offset some of the problems that are going to be created by the new federal tax code. What's up with that?
Yeah, and this is a very complicated topic that we could spend a lot of time discussing. Kind of the overarching idea is that Maryland is what's called coupled with the federal tax law. So if you want to take the standard deduction on your federal tax return, you also take this standard deduction on your Maryland tax return. Since the federal government, since the Congress increased the standard deduction at the federal level quite substantially and simultaneously capped several of the deductions that a lot of Maryland taxpayers would be taking advantage of, the state and local tax deduction, the mortgage interest deduction. As a result, many Maryland taxpayers are likely to want to take that standard deduction on the federal side, but they lose out on a lot of deductions by doing that on the state side. The end result is estimated to be several hundred million dollars in extra taxes that they're paying. So the governor, the Democratic leadership, and the Republican leadership have all proposed very similar remedies to this problem. The governor in particular wants to decouple Maryland and federal taxes, and he also wants to allow taxpayers to take the standard deduction on one and itemize on the other so that they would get the benefit of the best possible scenario for them on both federal and state taxes.
Yeah, and up to now, that's not been allowed. If you took the standard deduction on your federal return, you had to take it on the Maryland return. You couldn't split them. As they always say, the devil's in the details, and the devil's got a whole lot of detailing that he's done in this federal tax law. One of them has to do with the estate tax. The IRS will now start charging estate taxes, which some people on the political right like to refer to as death taxes, at $11 million, estates worth $11-something million. Is that also going to bleed over into the Maryland tax code?
So the I will preface this by saying that the estate tax, especially in Maryland in particular, but really everywhere, the sense I get from experts is the estate tax does not amount to a large amount of money for the state. That said, so Maryland has proposed effectively keeping the decoupling the estate tax from the federal estate tax, while the federal government has made the first 11 and change million dollars tax exempt. Maryland would hold the tax-exempt portion of estates at just over $5 million, which is where it is now, so that that additional, $6 million would still be subject to taxes.
All right. Not something that you and I are going to have to worry about anytime soon. Even something like the personal exemption on the federal side, that change could result in a whole lot of money to the state of Maryland, more than $1 billion, if it's not if the tax code in Maryland is not decoupled from the feds. How does that work?
Yeah, and this is another one. So this could be about a $1.2 billion, as you said. The Congress zeroed out the personal exemption. In other words, it still exists in the law, but it's a $0 value. So it's unclear, according to some people, whether that means Maryland's personal exemption would also go away. And the legislators have actually already put in and have moved forward a bill that would clarify that the personal exemption in Maryland is safe. People can still take that personal exemption.
Guns. There's some legislation about guns that the governor has proposed and the Democrats have proposed. What's up with that?
So the Democratic leadership has proposed two different measures. One would prohibit bump stocks and other devices that allow you to turn a semi-automatic weapon into an basically an automatic weapon. It what it does is it increases the rate of firing, so you don't have to press the trigger repeatedly in order to fire multiple times in a row. And
it was made famous in the terrible Las Vegas
shooting in October. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then the other thing they've proposed would eliminate the handgun review board. Basically, this is a politically appointed board that gets that people can appeal decisions by the Maryland State Police to deny them handgun licenses.
And Democrats charge that the governor is loading that board with people who are sympathetic to pro-gun ownership.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the governor does get to appoint people to this board. The data does not necessarily show that the board has actually been overruling the state police at a higher rate than it did under the previous administration. But the Democrats have proposed basically replacing that appeal process with an administrative law judge who presumably would be less biased than the politically appointed body that's there now.
How about the governor's budget? Baltimore had a thing in budgets passed called the Baltimore Package. What's the status of that in Governor Hogan's current iteration?
So this was a package passed in 2016, kind of in response to Freddie Gray's death and some of the uprisings that ensued. It was a package of about almost $300 million worth of programs. The governor had last year and again this year removed funding for a lot of these programs. Some of the ones of note are several million dollars for extended after school and summer school programming in jurisdictions that have high rates of low income students, and also for mentorship and scholarship program for students in the same jurisdictions with lots of low income students. And the last year, the legislature was able to refund those programs, find the money in the budget to refund those programs, and they expect to do the same again.
Got to finish up, but real quick, your reaction to the State of the State address. When I heard it, I was interested to see that the governor spent a lot of time saying we were all getting along so beautifully, unlike those guys in Washington, where it's all kumbaya around here in the state of Maryland.
Yeah, and I would really characterize this speech as it felt a lot like a campaign speech. Here are all the great things that we've done over the last 3 years. Here are all the great ways in which we work together and how we are not like the dysfunctional Washington politics. And here's you know, why you want to keep me in office, effectively. He didn't say it in so many words, but that's kind of what it felt like.
It is an election year. I'm also happy to say that the governor will be my guest here in Studio A week from Monday on the 19th, President's Day. Governor Hogan will make his first appearance on Midday. So I look forward to that. And we look forward to talking to you, Rachel, as the rest of the session unfurls. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too.
Rachel Bay covers the State House for us here at WYPR. We've got a link to Rachel's most recent stories at wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a break, love is in the air, or at least on the air. Essayist Tim Kreider joins me to talk about his latest book, I Wrote This Because I Love You. I'm Tom Hall, and I love you for listening to Midday. Stay with us.